What we're going to speak about today is eight different aspects, eight insights into the Haggadah, into the Seder. Some of them are halachic, some of them are more hashkafic, more philosophical. And let's pick. There's much we could say about the Seder, but we're going to take eight areas of the Seder that really conceptually give us a good insight into how it works. First is there's a paragraph at the beginning, halach ma'anya, at the very beginning of the Seder that disturbs all of us. Why does it disturb us? Because what happens? The rest of the Seder, the Haggadah, is in Hebrew. This is in Aramaic. Question number one. Question number two is, in Judaism, a person has to be honest. There's a huge value that we put on integrity and honesty. And what happens? Imagine you're sitting at a hotel, or you're in an apartment building on the 12th floor, and you're sitting there, call Dichvin Yesei V'Yechel. Anyone who's hungry, come on in and eat. Come on in and join us. What do you mean? No one's going to hear you, number one. Number two is, in some of the places that you're at, the security guards will stop the people even if they could hear. Isn't the time to invite one to the Seder now, prior to Pesach? When someone is looking for an invitation, when someone, you know, is in a situation where you can reach them and contact them? And not only is it disingenuous, but the next phrase, called Ditzrich Yesei V'Yivsach, anyone who needs to, come and be part of our Korban Pesach. Well, there's a very important halacha we know from Masechta Pesachim, that one only becomes part of the Korban Pesach, min ha-menuyin. You only are min ha-menuyin if what? If at the time of the Shechita, at the time the Pesach was shechted, which was the afternoon before the Seder, which was Erev Pesach, the 14th of Nisan, only then can you constitute part of the Chavura, part of the group that partakes of the Korban Pesach. It's prohibited otherwise to partake of the Korban Pesach if you're not min ha-menuyin mishas Shechita, those who were designated from the time of Shechita. So what do you mean? You're sitting there at the Seder, oh, anybody who needs to be part of our Pesach, come and join us. It's halachically not acceptable. So again, it's a very disturbing, very difficult paragraph. There are many approaches to this. We're going to take the approach of Rav Aaron Kahn. Rav Kahn took the following approach. He says, you know why this is in Aramaic? Because the vernacular language, the language that people spoke on the street, one to another, was Aramaic in the time of Bayashani during the Second Commonwealth. Hebrew was the language that we would use for the Mishnah. Hebrew was a scholarly language. But the language, the vernacular, the way we speak English, they spoke Aramaic. So what happens? You have to speak in a way where someone can understand and appreciate what you're saying. And you know when Halach Ma'anya, this paragraph was said? This paragraph was not said at the Seder. It was said earlier. It was said in the month, the weeks leading up, the days leading up to the Seder, where people would go and look, because the ultimate fulfillment of Simchas Yom Tov, the famous Rambam in Perek Vav, in chapter 6 of Hilchas Yom Tov, is that the Simchas Yom Tov is fulfilled by b'misameach acherim, those who wouldn't have a Seder otherwise, either because financially they can't afford one, or because educationally they wouldn't know how to make a Seder. They wouldn't know what to do at a Seder. Or because psychologically, emotionally, they're depressed. You know, financially they may have more than we have. Educationally they may be more learned than we are. But they're hurt, they're depressed, they're down, they're alone, recently separated, recently widowed, doesn't have family in town. That's the people, those are the people you invite to the Seder. That's Simchas Yom Tov. And that's the ultimate Simcha. Why was this put here? Why was this put into the Haggadah? We say in Yiddish, it's like a shtoch in the kishkas, a little zetz in the kishkas. Meaning what? You're sitting there with the finest china and the finest silver and beautiful sterling crystal stemware. The time to, you know, the ultimate Simcha is what I meant to say. The ultimate Simcha is what? It's not sitting there, you and your family, having this wonderful, luxurious dining experience with fine wines and fine foods. You know what Simcha is really about? You know what the most crucial aspect of the Seder is? Making sure that the Mari Nefesh, the Umlalim, to quote the Rambam, those who are hurting, those who are in need, that they're part of your Seder. That they have an experience of Simchas Yom Tov. And the Rambam says, if you don't take care of those people, if your suda is just, you know, MCI, friends and family, Ein's a Simchas Yom Tov, El a Simchas Kreso. That's not a real Simchas Yom Tov. That's a Simcha of the gut, of the bauch, of the stomach. And that's why you go out. That's why we go out and we look and we communicate and we make sure that the real Simchas Yom Tov that's described in Parshas Re'eh, you have Ata, V'ishtecha, Bincha, Bitcha, Avdecha, V'mascha, your family. But then it says, the Levi, the Ger, the Yasom, V'almana. What is a Levi? What is a convert, a widow, an orphan? These are categories of people that don't have a whole community, that don't have a whole network looking after them. Those are the people that should be part of your network, part of your Yom Tov meal and Yom Tov experience. That's Simchas Yom Tov. So before we start off the Seder, we make this statement. What is it a statement of? Did we do our job? Did we really prepare for the Seder by making sure that, look, and if someone goes away to a hotel or someone goes away for the holidays, that's why we have Maos Chitim. That's why we fund. We write serious checks of serious commitments to make sure that people have for their holiday, that they could have a joyous holiday and a meaningful holiday, and it doesn't break the bank. And they're able to pay the mortgage that month and pay the gas bills that month. That's Halach Manya. The second point we're going to make is vis-a-vis Manishtana. We called this year, why is this night different than all other nights? If you look at the Rambam in Perek Zayin and Perek Ches of Hilchos Chametz Matzah, he says, Ve'omer HaKore. The Rambam says that Manishtana is not per se a question. Manishtana is a statement. How unique, how distinct is this night? What makes this night, not why is this night different, but how unique and distinct is this night from all other nights? And what is its unique distinctiveness? Halachically, it's a night where any other night you don't have to eat any staple. Certain nights, there's a mitzvah d'rabbanan to have a staple, Shabbos, Yom Tov. But that could be chametz, could be matzah, whatever staple you want. This is the one night a year there's an obligation from the Torah to have matzah. Be'erev tochlu matzos. That's its uniqueness. Other nights, you want vegetables, you don't want vegetables, this vegetable, that vegetable. Tonight there's an obligation. There's an obligation of maror. What else is unique about this night? All other nights, you could sit, you could recline. How you want to eat is up to you. Tonight there's an obligation to recline. And it's not just the aristocracy. Everyone is aristocracy tonight. Everyone reclines. What's unique about this night? Other nights, you want to dip, you don't want to dip, right? You know, do you want a kind of relish to accompany what you're eating? It's your choice. Tonight there's an obligation, two different events, two different occasions, at Karpas and at Maror. In other words, it's defining halachically what makes this night unique and distinct. See, we think of it as, the kids ask questions. It's true that this is a night of questioning. It's a night of analysis. It's a dialectic. It's a night of back and forth and challenging and discussing and developing and learning together. That's absolutely true. However, there's a big however here. Besides that, this is a night of what? It's a night which is unique, which is distinct. And we demarcate its unique and distinctive nature. Where is there an obligation to do that? Where does there an obligation to do that? So if you look in the Rambam, again, Perek Zayin, Perek Ches of Hilchos Chametz Matzah, the Rambam says the source for the Seder is not v'higadat levincha, which is what other Rishonim like Rashi say, to communicate over, to tell over the story, to tell over the special uniqueness of the night. No, the Rambam says, Zachar es yom hazeh, remember the day Asher Yitzasim in Mitzrayim, that you left Egypt. Kimoshe Namar. The Rambam says, just like it says by Shabbos. Zachor es Yom HaShabbos L'Kadsho. What does that mean, Kimoshe Namar, just like it says by Shabbos? Shabbos, obviously, is a paradigm that is teaching us something unique about this mitzvah. So what's the mitzvah of Zachor es Yom HaShabbos L'Kadsho? To articulate. Zachor here means to articulate, to communicate that which makes Shabbos unique and distinct. We designate it, we define it as a unique time. So too this night. This night on the calendar is a unique, distinct time. And how do we do that? We say historically and philosophically through Arami Oved Avi, its unique moment or its unique impact on history. and as well, halachically, what makes this night different than all other nights. That's how the Rambam understands Manishtana. It's not a question, it's a statement. The next point, point number three, is the Arba Banim, the four sons. So we know the following. There's a major debate that exists, a huge debate as to what is the ideal form of education. There's a pro and con to each approach. We're going to call one homogeneous, the other heterogeneous. What's homogeneous education? Where we take like groups and we in a razor-sharp precision way, we have tracking where we'll have certain people with certain proclivities in classes with each other and other people with other proclivities in classes with people like themselves. Meaning what? In math and science, in language, right? There are people who have gifts and skills in languages. There are other people who have gifts and skills with math and science. You know, and then there are the people who are more artistic, and their gifts and skills are in that area. So in all of these areas, we have different grades. We have different tiers, so to speak. We track it. Now, the positive to that is it makes it a lot easier on the teacher. Instead of a teacher having to teach to a class of 8 or 9 different levels, the teacher can focus in on maybe 2 levels. Much easier, and chances are that teacher will accomplish much more and the students will learn much more. What's the downside of that? Remember Welcome Back, Kotter, right? John Travolta got his start as Vinnie Barbarino, the Sweat Hogs. There was a self-fulfilling prophecy. I remember I taught in yeshiva where there was tracking. And there were the people in the lower track. They viewed themselves as not accomplishing anything in life. We're the sweat hogs. We're the dummies. And the people in the top shear, in the top track, what do they feel? You know, we're God's gift to humanity. Inherently, we're better. We're superior. Just by the fact or by dint of the fact that they're at a certain academic level in a certain area. It's very problematic. Now, 20-some years later, I've got to tell you, the people in the lowest track, you know, sweat hogs, they're the ones who are employing all the goody two-shoes. Why? Because these people were very street smart in the lower track, and they knew how to deal with life. The great academicians were just that. They were academicians. But when it comes to getting out into the real world, you know, their skill sets were not as honed. They didn't have the EQ of those in the lower tracks. And again, I'm generalizing. But what's the point? It's not healthy. It's very healthy academically and educationally. It's not healthy emotionally and psychologically. On the other hand, you want to go the other approach, heterogeneous. We put, you know, multiple learning abilities, multiple learning styles, we put them all in one classroom. That way, you know, no one is made to feel they're in the dumb class and no one's in the gifted elite class. Yeah, but you know what happens? For a teacher to teach to 8 or 9 different levels is extremely difficult. Nishta zoi pashut, not so simple. And those classes will not accomplish as much. The students will not learn as much. There'll be a frustration for the better students. There'll be a frustration for the weaker students. Because by definition, a teacher can only target a certain, you know, only certain levels. And that's problematic. On the other hand, everyone is together. We're all equals. On the other hand, no one is made to feel a certain type of stigma. So this is the debate you have in education. What does Judaism have to say about this? So if we could quote Shlomo HaMelech from Mishlei, Chanoch lanar al pidarka. What does Shlomo say? Educate each person, each youth, so to speak, according to his or her unique abilities. Some people are audio learners. I mean, myself. I have a much easier time learning when I'm listening to a shiur or attending a shiur. Some people are not. They tone out. They're not great listeners, but they're fantastic readers. They learn well at reading. Others are experiential learners. When they're doing, they learn. They need to be doing and creating and accomplishing. They're not going to learn the sugyas of tzitzis from Masechta Menachos. But if you teach them how to make tzitzis, that they do very well at. So you have different types of learners. This is true across the board. Now, what does the Haggadah say? The Haggadah is saying the following. Seder night, we actually are giving multiple different siddurim because the people sitting at our Seder table have different learning abilities and learning styles. And one Haggadah, so to speak, I don't mean one Haggadah, I mean one Seder does not fit all. Because one Seder does not fit all, we have to end up doing what? We have to end up having multi-layered and multi-tiered Sedarim that speak to different learners. Who are some of those learners? Well, She'eino Yodea Lishol. The person's not even asking a question. Now, we're going to explain the Arbabanim, the four sons, or the different type of learners. We're going to explain these different learners on two levels. One is from a developmental perspective, meaning age-appropriate education. But secondly, we're going to describe it not from an age-appropriate, but we're going to speak about it from proclivities. Let's assume for argument's sake that everyone at the table has a certain intellectual capability, but what? They have different proclivities in terms of how they look at something. And let's explain. She'eino yodea lishol. We'll start with that level. What's she'eino yodea lishol? Doesn't even know how to ask a question. You have children. They're young. They don't even, not at the point where they can ask the question. But you have adults like that. Not because they're lack in terms of IQ. They're just not interested. It doesn't float their boat. It doesn't stimulate them. It doesn't engage them. They're not asking questions. They're not that interested. They're not against, but it's not exciting. So you have to engage that person. You have to stimulate that person. You have to get their curiosity going. Then you have the Tom. So developmentally, that's a younger child, older than She'eino Yodea Lishol, because at least they're curious. They're bothered by something. But it's not a developed question. It's not a sophisticated question. Mazos, what is this? Now, with adults, what's the Tom? We know many people. They see things one-dimensionally. They look at the world in simple categories. They don't deal well with shades of gray, with nuance, with subtleties, with ambiguities, with abstractions. That's a Tom. And you have to be concrete. They will appreciate something if it's real, tangible, and concrete. Then you have the Chacham. So if a Tom is a 6 or 7 year old, the Chacham is a 9 or 10 year old. They can develop a question. It's not just what is this. They actually know what bothers them. And they can articulate and spell out very clearly what it is that they have an issue with, what it is that bothers them. That's a sophisticated student. Developmentally, it's a more developed learner. But with adults, it's true also. You have people that giving them a simple, concrete answer, when life is not simple, when life is three-dimensional, gray, when life is has abstractions, you're going to have to speak in a much more analytical way to them. You're going to have to speak in a much more nuanced way to them. And that's how they learn. Most of the Haggadah is speaking to the Ben HaChacham. It's not speaking to the Tam or the She'eino Yodea Lishol. What's the fourth category? The fourth category is the Rasha. Intellectually, the Rasha is at the same level as the Chacham. They can deal with abstractions, with subtleties, with nuance. They can analyze. They have that ability. However, where the Rasha differs from the Chacham is in the area of emotions. The Rasha is emotionally challenged, meaning what? The Chacham is coming and giving you an opportunity. The Chacham is asking you a question. Will they accept your answer? It depends if it's a proper answer or not. But they're interested and they're open to hearing how you can address the issue that they're studying, the issue that bothers them, the issue that they want to know about. The rush is closed. They may formulate it as a question, but they're not asking. What does the Torah say about the rush? Ki yomru aleichem b'neichem. When they tell you, ki yomru aleichem b'neichem, they're telling you. So again, so a lot of times someone can tell you something even though they may formulate it as a question. That person is not so simple because they're not open to hearing what you have to say, what your response is. So how do you have a Seder for the Rasha? And let me make one thing clear. The Rasha is not someone who's evil. That's a poor translation. Technically, halachically, what's the definition of a Rasha? A Rasha is a sinner. Avaryan, right? A sinner. They're not an evil person. If they're such a terrible, wicked person, why are they coming home for Seder? They're coming to be at your table with you. Okay? They want to participate. They feel, to a certain degree, like they're part of the family. They're not out to attack you, to hurt you. What's the Russia? The Russians are like a lot of people we know. Listen, I'm happy to come home. You know, let's have a dinner. Let's sit back, have a dinner. Afterwards, you know, we'll watch the Ten Commandments again. This year is an early year, but most years the NBA playoffs. We'll get a good chance to watch LeBron or Kobe. You know, what are you hocking me? You're carrying on for 2-3 hours. By the time you want to sit down to the meal, it's so late, you know, you can't digest your food well. And then you give me these huge pieces of matzah, and you give me these huge leaves of romaine lettuce, what you call maror. And I can't, by the time I'm going to get to the meal, number one, I wasn't hungry, it's so late. Number two is I'm constipated from the matzah. What are you doing to me? Why can't it just be fun and enjoyable? The Russia is not evil. The Russia is just not committed. The Russia is not willing to exert the same kind of energy. Ilu haya sham lo haya nigal. If he was there, you think he would have stood up and taken a position, knowing full well how the Egyptians viewed the lamb and how they revered the lamb? You think he would have put the blood on the doorposts? You think he would have made that kind of a commitment? No. He wants it when it's easy, when it's nice, when it's simple. On his terms, not on God's terms. It's not a life of being committed. It's not a life of responsibility. It's a life of when it's nice and convenient and pleasant. It's not, again, he's not a wicked person, but he's not a committed person. And that's the tragedy. So what's the point? He's not interested in what you have to say, because if he's going to open up to what you have to say, that person has to change their life. That person has to take on a sense of responsibility. That person has to lead a committed life. So what do they do instead? How do you speak to such a person who has the block? So there's a great phrase in Yiddish, and I apologize that I don't know the Yiddish phrase, but those of you who do, what you want to say to your daughter-in-law, you say to your tochter, to the daughter, meaning what? If you would really tell your daughter-in-law what you really think and what you feel, she'll prevent your kids from having a relationship with you. She'll hold it against you the rest of your life. Forget it. You'll lose your relationship. You'll lose your son. You will lose your grandchildren. What do? You say to your daughter what you want the daughter-in-law to hear. In other words, you speak to the daughter-in-law by not speaking to her, by not addressing her. So her guard is down, and she won't take it personally, but you speak to the daughter, and that way the daughter-in-law understands. I'll give you an example. The best darshanim, they want to talk about issues of adolescence, which are major issues to every family, issues of challenging, the challenge of raising students, of children. What do? You talk about David and Adoniyahu, or you talk about David and Avshalom. Right? And obviously, you can't sit and project modern psychology onto David. We don't know what David and Avshalom's relationship was like based upon the Midrashim and Mefarshim. And you analyze it. People's guard is down. They don't feel like you're hitting them over the head. You're doing an analysis of adolescent issues. And you know what? That's when they internalize. That's when they appreciate it. That's when they're open. So what happens here? If you look at the answer to the Russia in the Torah, that's not what the Haggadah quotes. What is the quoted as the answer to the Russia? The Vilna Gaon says this. What is the Haggadah quote? It quotes the answer to the She'eno Yodea Lishol, that young, impressionable, naive little kid. That's the one that you say something to. Bavur zeh asa Hashem li, leave alolo. If you were speaking to the Russia, you'd say, leave alo lecha. It says, ilu hayasham. If he were there, lo haya nigal. Should have said, ilu hayisasham. If you were there, you wouldn't have been redeemed. So the way you speak to him is by, you're speaking to him. You're speaking to him by not speaking to him. You're speaking to him by speaking about him to the impressionable kid. That's the way you have an impact on a Russia. It has to be in a very subtle way like that. There's much more, but we're going to move on. The main point is going back to what we said. Our Seder to be an effective Seder. And remember, a Seder is a paradigm for the rest of the year. It's not just a one-time thing. It's a paradigm for the rest of the year. It has to be an evening of dialogue, not monologue. It has to be an evening of stirring on people's curiosity. You look at the Rambam's explanation, what's karpas? Karpas was you'd bring out the whole meal, they'd start with the hors d'oeuvres, and then they'd pull away to main course and everything else. Hey, what's going on here? And it was a way of spurring on curiosity. The minhag of wearing a kittel. What is this? Not Yom Kippur. It's not a funeral. Why are you wearing a kittel? The Rambam says you're mechalek egozim uklayos. You give out different types of nuts. That was our form of candies. I'm sorry, their form of candies. What was the idea? Normally you have to eat all your Brussels sprouts and your string beans, and then you get a candy at the end of the meal. Here, the kid thinks he's died and gone to heaven. What do you mean? You didn't force me to eat Brussels sprouts or broccoli or spinach, and you're giving me candies right off the bat? Oh my God, what's going on? This never happens. That's the idea. We do all kinds of things that spur on curiosity. We encourage questions. The rest of the year, Reb Chaim says this, Rav talked about this. The rest of the year, the concept of the Exodus of Egypt is a monologue. We read the third paragraph of Shema. What happens this night? We don't read a text. We analyze, we study, we dialogue. There's a whole dialectic going on. It's an analysis, it's a study. It's question and answer. And that ideally is what the Jewish family experience, the Jewish dining experience should be. That comfort of sitting around the table, that comfort of food and drink should hopefully be an opportunity, a catalyst for engagement, for stimulation. That's the ideal. The next point, Dayenu, and we're just going to make it briefly because we need to move on. Dayenu, which literally means this would suffice, this would be enough of a reason to express gratitude. Seder night. And by the way, that is, we've mentioned before, why is it that the text of the Haggadah is not the story of the Exodus? It's not Shmos Ve'erabo, those sections of the book of Exodus that would be the description of the events of the Shibud Mitzrayim, the whole experience in Egypt, and then the Geula, the redemption of that experience. Why? Because it's not a night of history. It's not a night that we study history. It's a night that we use history as a means to an end. History is the vehicle, what we call didactic history. It's the vehicle that enables us, the Rav used to say this, to have a profound sense of gratitude to the Almighty. It's a night of gratitude. That's why did we choose Arami Oved Avi, this story, which is a declaration the Jewish farmer makes when the crop comes in. The Jewish farmer declares before God his gratitude. Not just for this year. Oh, it's a good bumper crop. The family's going to eat this year. We're going to put something away. We'll be able to save something. Wonderful. May be able to expand, you know, buy some more properties. That's not what the farmer says. The farmer goes all the way back to the beginning. I was a pagan, illiterate slave. That's what I come from. And we were the lowest rung on a caste system in Mitzrayim. And you extricated us from a place that no one escaped. You took a nation, goy mi kerev goy. And you took care of our psychological and emotional problems, our inferiority complex, all of it. You emancipated us, you educated us, you transformed us into the people of the book, to the Dordea, the people of wisdom, of insight. You gave us a homeland where not only where we would grow, but we could have an impact and shape the destiny of humanity, the destiny of civilization. You go all, every step of the way through. Rav Kahn used to use the analogy. You could imagine this scenario. The employer gives his employee a bonus. Very nice. Thank you, sir. Thank you. I appreciate the bonus. I appreciate the raise. But imagine this. Let's say that employee was so gone. He was so drugged out with no health care. They had to take him to the Salvation Army's detox. And he was literally a rat. He was less than an animal, no less a human being. And this man, we'll call him the employer, he took him out of the Salvation Army detox. And he put him into a program, and he put him into a clinic, and he spent a fortune on him. And once the person was weaned off of the drugs, off the addiction, which you're never really weaned off of, but he weans him off of it, and then he gives him a job, and he gives him an opportunity. And the person starts to have a sense of self-worth, of self-value and self-respect when he never respected himself before. And he educates. He doesn't just employ the person. He educates and he trains the person. And over the years, the person starts to work his way up. The more self-respect, the more self-worth, the more they accomplish, the more. And he grows in the company. And eventually he comes to a point where he can marry and have a family and be responsible for someone else. When you say thank you for that raise, you don't just say thank you for the raise. I was a rat. I was a pseudo quasi animal. And you invested in me and you cared about me and you emancipated me and you got me off of the drugs and you taught me self-worth and self-respect and you trained me and you mentored me and you were a guardian angel to me. That's Hakara Satov. That's thank you. That's what we do Seder night. That's what the Jewish farmer does. Why is Arami Oved Avi chosen and not the story of the Exodus? Because that is the text par excellence. It's the text of Hakara Satov, of gratitude, of a profound sense of gratitude par excellence. And it's not just Arami Oved Avi. That's the role of Dayenu, that's the role of Hallel. It's a night of gratitude. What does it mean, B'chol Dor V'Dor, in every generation? We experience our own emancipation. We don't just tell a lesson and tell a story about what happened to our progenitors. We experience it. Because when you feel it, when you put yourself in the Indian's moccasins, when you internalize it and demonstrate it and act it out, then you start to appreciate it. You start to have a small sense of profound gratitude for what Hashem did, where we would be and where we are. That is what happens this night. And that's the role of Dayenu. Everybody asks the question, what does it mean? Ilu kervanu lifnei har Sinai velo nasan lanu es haTorah. What was the whole purpose of showing up to Sinai? It was to get the Torah. What do you mean? If you would have brought us to Sinai but not given us the Torah. So what did the Mefarshim say? I'm just using this as one example. The experience. The experience where we perceived God. Hashra'as hashchina. Where now we know Moshe's not making it up. We perceived that intense experience where we perceived God and the knowledge of God and the awareness of God. That in itself was a value. That in itself defines us. That in itself makes us different Jews, different human beings, even if the covenant had not been given. Every step of the way, that's Dayenu. We express our gratitude for each and every stage. We're going to skip now to Rabban Gamliel. Just a simple question. Gamliel Haya Omer, Kol Shelo Amar Shlosha Dvarim Elu BaPesach Lo Yatsa Yedecha Vasa. Anyone who does not say the following three paragraphs, explaining that why we eat the Pesach, why we eat the Matzah, why we eat the Maror, has not fulfilled his obligation. What does that mean, has not fulfilled his obligation? What does that mean? What obligation? So there's a famous debate between the Rambam on one hand and the Ramban and Marsha on the other hand. What obligation? So according to the Rambam, Lo Yatsi Yedei Chovaso hasn't fulfilled their obligation of Sipur Yitzias Mitzrayim. Sipur Yitzias Mitzrayim is not accomplished by analyzing Arami Ovid Avi. It's not just what makes this night unique, going back to where we started. What makes this night unique and special historically and philosophically? That's part of the mitzvah. What makes this night unique and distinct halachically? You haven't fulfilled your mitzvah unless you talk about what? What makes this night unique? This is the one night a year we eat Korban Pesach. It's the one night a year by Erev Tochlu Matzah, there's an obligation to eat matzah. It's the one night a year, there's an obligation to eat maror. You haven't fulfilled Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim if you haven't spelled out what makes it special and distinct on a halachic level. That's the Rambam, and that's the way most learn. The Ramban and the Marsha say something else. You haven't fulfilled your mitzvah of matzah. You haven't fulfilled your mitzvah of eating the roasted lamb, Korban Pesach. You haven't fulfilled the mitzvah of maror unless you explain why you're eating them. You don't just do it. It's show and tell. You explain why you're doing what you're doing. It says, v'amartam zevech Pesach. It's not enough to eat the Pesach, you have to talk about it. Lechem oni, lechem sha'onim alav dvarim harbe, the Gemara in Psachim Lamed Vav. You don't just eat the matzah, you articulate and you spell out what the matzah represents and why you're eating the matzah. That's their understanding. Now, what is this? This machlokas, a beautiful machlokas, but philosophically it gives us tremendous insight into what the nature of the Seder is, into what the nature of Judaism is, right? The nature of the Seder is, we said this, it's on one hand, it's communicating the story to the Tam in a simple, concrete way, to the Chacham in a much more nuanced, subtle way with all the Midrashim and Arami Ovid Avi, and as well on a halachic level. It's to a Tam on a simple, concrete way, but to the Chacham, if you look at the answer the Seder gives to the Chacham, you pull out all of Masechta Pesachim. You do an analysis of the mitzvahs of the night. The Afata Emorlo, the Ritva and the Gon have the Girsa, call Hilchos Pesach. You analyze the different halachos. Ad, they add the word ad, until what? Ein maftir nachar Pesach avikomen. What does that mean? Until ein maf, it's a quote. Ein maftir nachar Pesach avikomen is one of the last Mishnayos in Masechta Pesachim. It's the end of Arvei Pesachim. It's one of the last halachas of the Seder. It's an analysis. Not just philosophically with the Midrashim. You know, we have in our Haggadah about the Chachamim that were in the attic in Bnei Brak. Well, there's a Tosefta, I believe, that says they stayed up all night in the attic because they were, you know, the Romans were, was public Jewish education was prohibited, so they had to do it incognito. They stayed up all night learning Hilchos Pesach. Not analyzing Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, but learning Hilchos Pesach. And there's no contradiction, because both of them fulfill, as the Rambam told us, the nature of the mitzvah, the demarcation of the uniqueness of this night. That's one level. And the other level, as we said, is you have to understand why we do what we do. You have to relate to why we do what we do. That's the Ramban and the Marsha. The next piece we're going to talk about is the Hallel. That's section 6 and 7. And we're going to go briefly. Another time we'll have a full shiur on this. But we're just going to spend 5 to 10 minutes. I mean, there's some very disturbing things about this Hallel. Number one is there's no bracha. How do Chazal mandate something with no bracha? Every other time you say Hallel, you say it with a bracha. Every time that it was legislated by Chazal. Question number two is very strange. You break up the Hallel. You say the first two paragraphs, now we're going to have a meal. We're going to sit down and eat dinner. What is that? Well, could you imagine if in the morning in shul, in the middle of Hallel, we take out our matzahs and we start eating? I throw you out of shul. It's sacrilegious. It's disrespectful. But Seder night, what do? We start the Hallel and we stop and we have a meal. And then after we bench, we go back and say the rest of the Hallel. What is that? Very strange. And why the breakup there? Why the first, according to Beis Hillel, first two paragraphs you do before the meal, the rest of Hallel, the majority of Hallel you do after the meal? So the Rav developed this. There's really, the Hallel that we say Seder night is not the commemorative Hallel that we say on Hanukkah or on a holiday morning, Pesach, Sukkah, Shavuos, where we've been legislated by the rabbis to make a statement that commemorates what? That commemorates this great event in history. That's not what we're doing. That's not what we're doing. What are we doing? You know what we're doing? This is, to quote the Brisker Rav, and the Rav, this is Hallel al Hanes. B'Torah Shira, we're saying this Hallel. Meaning what? When we confront Providence, we break out in song. Meaning, as the Seder started, we were analyzing what happened to our progenitors, to Avosenu. As the Seder progresses, Bechol dor v'dor chayav adam liros es atzmo. Person has to see oneself, kiilu hu yatza mimitzrayim, as if I am going out of Egypt. It's not about my progenitors, it's about my experience. And if I'm experiencing and reliving that experience, what is demanded of a Jew? Halachically, what's demanded of a Jew when they encounter Providence, when they encounter the miraculous? They break out in Hallel. They break out in Shira. What did the Jews do at Yam Suf? They broke out in Az Yashir Moshe of Neisrael Shira Zos. Shira Sayam. That is the response. That is the halachic response to encountering the miraculous. And that's what we do Seder night. Those first two paragraphs is our encounter with our own emancipation, with the providential hand of God through Makas Bechoros, and free after all those decades of slavery, after the century of slavery. It's not the commemorative Hallel. It's Hallel al Hanes. It's the Hallel that is the Jews' response, halakhic response to Providence. Now, that's only the first two paragraphs. That's only the first two paragraphs. Why? That's what we call Hallel HaMitzri. The fourth cup of wine, which we call the cup over the Hallel, that's a different Hallel. It's a totally different Hallel. It's not Hallel al Hanes. It's not Shira in response to Hashgacha. You know what it is? That is a Hallel that we say, we're no longer leaving Egypt. We're back in 2013. We're back in a world where the jihadists are now sitting on our northern border in Syria. We're in a world where when you look at the logs of the United Nations General Assembly and you look at the logs of the United Nations Security Council and all their subdivisions, where we are once again, 70 years after Auschwitz, we're a pariah nation. We're in a world where the Iranians are enriching plutonium and uranium. And they're almost at the red line where they publicly declare that they will annihilate the Jewish homeland. We're not in ecstasy. We're not reliving our emancipation where we've become freed after the century of slavery. Oh no. We're back into the 2013. We're back into the world of the here and now, which is a very challenging reality. What happens? It's a world of BDS movements. It's a world of lawfare. It's a world of delegitimization. So what happens? The rest of the Hallel is very different. It's not like Kapitlach 113 and 114 that are kulo shevach vehoda takarish baruch, that are only praise and gratitude. The rest of the Hallel is much more complex. It has petition. It reflects the state of need and the state of pain that we're in. Mina Meitzer Karasiya. Out of dire straits, I call out to you, God. Ana Hashem Oshiyana, please, God, save me. Just basic, save us, save our state, save our homeland, save us, enable us to exist. Ani Avdecha Ben Amasecha. I'm not communicating to God as his son, his firstborn son. I'm a servant, the son of a maidservant. Tzara v'yagon emsa, pain and moaning and agony I've found. Meaning what? Yes, there's Hodul Hashem Ki Tov. Yes, there's praise. Yes, there's gratitude, 100%. But it's mixed in with what? It's mixed in with petition, with crying out, with beseeching God. That's the real tefillah. It's a tefillah on the one hand of gratitude and praise, and at the same time of need. That's a different Hallel. Totally different Hallel. That Hallel, we're asking for the ultimate geula. We haven't made it. We haven't come to the finish line. We have a long way to go. We're asking for geulas Mashiach. We're asking for nishmas kol chai. What's nishmas kol chai? That not just the Jewish people who were redeemed at one point in history, but not only do we need to be redeemed, but the redemption of all of humanity. We pray to God, we beseech God for the redemption of all of humanity. Look and translate it nishmas. It's a different Hallel. We can develop this, and we'll go into it further another time. But where I want to end, because it's two, the Hallel of the second cup and the Hallel of the fourth cup are radically different. One is reliving and experiencing our own emancipation. The other is a tefillah of, on the one hand, gratitude that we've made it through four millennia of our history, but on the other hand, beseeching God for the ultimate geula, the ultimate redemption, which is not just the Jewish redemption, it's the redemption of all of humanity, the perfection of all of humanity, the transformation of all of humanity. That's a very, very different Hallel. Where we're going to end is the following. We've mentioned this possibly in other shiurim. This is in the name of Rabbi Yehuda Silver, Talmud of the Rav. It says, there's two times a year we say Lashana Abab Yerushalayim. At the end of the Seder, Lashana Abab Yerushalayim, and in the Ilah, the end of Yom Kippur. Why those two times? We don't say it every holiday. We don't even say it, we say it at a unique time in the holiday. What's Lashana Abab Yerushalayim? What is that? So he explained the following. We've said this on the Yom Kippur Shir. Rabbi Silver said like this. There are two times a year we're to quote the phrase, Ikar chaser min ha-sefer. You know, the little lady who used to come into Wendy's, where's the beef? The beef is missing. The essence is missing. Meaning what? On Rosh Hashanah, if we don't have a Beis HaMikdash, our Rosh Hashanah is our tfilos, it's the shofar, it's the Isser Malacha. It's primarily a Rosh Hashanah. Whether it's in Alaska, Beverly Hills, whether it's in Jacksonville, or whether it's in Yerushalayim. And that's true of a Shabbos. And to a great degree, that not totally, but to a great degree, that's true of a Sukkos or Shavuos. There's 2 days a year it's not the case. One is Yom Kippur. Masechta Yuma analyzes all of the mitzvahs of Yom Kippur, the Avodas Hayom. 7 out of 8 prakim, we can't observe today. We talk about it, we explain it, right? Atakonanta, Amitz Koach, depending if you're a Sfardi or an Ashkenazi. So we talk about it, we read it, but we can't observe it. Only 1 out of 8 chapters is Halacha Lamaisa, because we don't have a Beis HaMikdash, tragically. So we do our best, we try on Yom Kippur. But acharei kichlos hakol, after 5 tfilos, after a marav shachris, a musaf, a mincha nila, after everything we've done over 24 hours, we say l'shana haba Yerushalayim. Please, God, enable us to observe this day, to relate to you, to observe this day the way it was meant to be observed, the right way. And that can only be with the restored Beis HaMikdash, with the Kohen Gadol, where there can be the par, the sayer, there can be the avodas hayom, there can be the incense, there can be the sayer mishtaleach. None of that's applicable today. And the second time is after Seder. Because this night, what's the fulcrum? What's the essence of this night? The Korban Pesach. The reflection of Seder, of Pesach Mitzrayim, of that date, is the Korban Pesach. We can't have it. So there is a mitzvah of matzah, separate mitzvah, if you don't have a Pesach, be'erev tochlu matzos. But the ideal matzah is al matzah rorim yochluhu. Maror? There's no mitzvah of maror. The maror we eat is a zecher. It's strictly a rabbinic zecher to the ideal. Where you have that lavash, the wrap, of the roasted Pesach with the maror wrapped in the matzah. There's no korban chagiga. So we do the best we can. And we have a seder, and we have a haggadah, and we eat matzah. And rabbinically as a zecher, we eat maror. But the whole thing is missing. The essence of what it is, where the whole nation would converge on Yerushalayim, and we eat as a chavura, the Korban Pesach, Ikar chaser min ha-sefer. You know, Masech the Psachim, it's called Psachim in the plural. Why in the plural? Because one deals with the Isser of Chametz, and the cleaning, and the bittel, the Bedikas Chametz, and the bittel Chametz. And there's a whole other Masechta there. There's a whole other Masechta Pesach that deals with Korban Pesach. Half the tractate is not applicable. It's not true of Masechta Sukkah. It's not true of Masechta Rosh Hashanah. The whole thing is missing. So we've done the best we can. It's a pale shadow. It's a skeleton. This pale shadow, this skeleton, we do the best we can. But acharei kichlos hakol, when it's all said and done, we say, God, please, please accept it, nirtza, but l'shana haba b'Yerushalayim. Next year we want to observe it, the way it was meant to be observed, the real McCoy. And that's our tefillah at the end of the Seder. So there's much more to the Seder, but these are some of the themes, some of the motifs, and some of the crucial parts of the Seder that we, if you look on outorah.org, the Arami Oved Avi, that we analyze. There's a shir on Arami Oved Avi. That's very crucial, because that's the essential Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. What we did tonight was we discussed some of the other issues and some of the other topics. I want to wish everyone a meaningful Chag, a meaningful Pesach, for not only you and your families, but for Gan's Klal Yisrael. And when it's all said and done, we hope that we'll observe it to the best of our abilities, but L'shana Haba B'Yerushalayim.